Thank you for coming to this session. I can see that we have time for six questions at the end. That's one each. Unlike, obviously, a lot of people, I chose this session to be chair of because I thought it sounded like the most interesting session that there was going to be. So here we are on the three Ps of life insurance. We probably all studied the three Ps of investment in property when we were younger. Position, position, position. And today it is... Well, they'll tell us what the three Ps are. I know there were three of them, but I can't remember them. But practices was the one that got my attention. Processes, products and practices. We're here to hear from Kenny McIver on my right and John Nichols further over, both from Willis Towers Watson. I've got a very short bio for Kenny, which says he's got over 10 years of experience. I happen to know a bit more about Kenny. Kenny went to my second favourite university, Heriot Watt in Edinburgh. Where my brother also attended. My brother did a much more interesting degree, however. He did a brewing degree. Yeah. So if the questions dry up, then Kenny might be able to tell us something about Edinburgh Ale. I'm sure he studied it informally, if not formally. John, also from Willis Towers Watson, is in the insurance consulting and technology business. He has been working there since 1990. So John is going to start us off, and we're going to hear from his experience and products, practices, and processes. No, not products. Processes.
Processes, products, and practices. Thanks, Paul, for the introduction there. Yes, as Paul's introduced, Kenny and I are going to talk about transformation in this session today, sharing insights from our work with clients and as well as transformation that we've been through within our own business, Willis Towers Watson, over the years there. In the insurance space, certainly our business has evolved over time from offering financial projection software and a lot of consulting services built around that, M&A, product development, et cetera, through to offering a much broader range of services and software tools that go along with that. So certainly seeing a lot more increased focus these days around data management, automation and governance aspects, not so much just that, the pure underlying actuarial tools. Technology started. There we go. So first, just a we'll walk through the agenda. So we'll start with an overview of some drivers and triggers for transformation projects that we've seen here in Australia and also from the UK, drawing on Kenny's experience as well as elsewhere. We'll go into some more specifics around specific aspects of transformations themselves and uncover some a bit more about their nature and looking into three main areas around product transformation, product evolution, and process improvement. So under the area of products, we'll look at three particular types, talk a little bit about participating business, retirement products, and protection products. And Kenny will talk a little bit about practice evolution and some there about risk modelling, demand modelling, and pricing. And then we'll move on to process improvement. And Kenny will talk through some detail around nine tips for initiating, executing and completing a process improvement project. And that will draw heavily on the experience that we have from completing these projects around the world. So first, drivers of transformation. And we'll look ultimately to set out a number of such drivers. But first of all, look at, what are some of the underlying objectives we see four transformation projects and showing them here on the left side of the screen on there. Sure, these are all familiar with to us and overly breaking new ground here. So first of all, timetable optimization. So this here we can think about decreasing the time it takes to complete tasks and also getting more, how can we get more done in the time that's available to us. Cost efficiencies. can we utilise less resources to get our work done, or cheaper resources? And thinking here holistically about, you know, the people effort that's required, but more than the people effort, also, you know, hardware costs. We may be able to, you know, reduce our people effort, but, you know, is the hardware cost that we need to do that going to justify moving into it? Or the ongoing software fees associated with that, you know, going to outweigh, you know, the potential benefit. Quality assurance. So, you know, we need to get our work done, and we need to be able to increasingly demonstrate that, whereas in the past, you know, it's been certainly a challenging area. So that's where things like, you know, improving the processes for handling the data, how we handle assumptions, deal with our models, update our models over time, produce our results and prepare our analysis, and trying to do that in a way that we can demonstrate we have, you know, quality processes that we're adhering to. Agility. So again, yeah, this is about speed, but with a slightly different context here. Agility are more getting ourselves in a position to be able to meet new challenges and demands as they arise on there. And finally, the other area there is integration. So making sure the tools we have, which are the kind of the best fit for any particular task, they're also able to communicate and interact with each other as they're. So, you know, that may be some of the objectives. We'll also kind of, you know, look through in terms of, you know, the underlying trigger, and we'll show those through external, through internal sources. So, you know, from market factors, regulatory factors, across to the right on, you know, management information. So some more specific examples. Things like, you know, competitive pressures, we're all going to face those, and often they're going to lead us to be looking to offer a more competitive more competitive price, more competitive product. So you'll be looking for ways to control or improve our cost efficiencies. So, you know, looking at things like automation, what benefit can that done? You know, can we be more capital efficient, get more from the same amount of capital that we have allocated to the business? Is there something new we can offer to differentiate, for example? Market disruption. You know, I think we'll probably hear quite a bit about market disruption over the session today. You know, things like Discovery Life in South Africa, you know, bringing in, you know, new approaches to products. How are we going to be able to react to examples such of that? Other things, you know, we're always faced with political change, regulatory change. Who knows what the next government's going to do in terms of, you know, superannuation, for example. You know, they all promise things. Once they get in, they'll do something different from what they've set out to start with on there. You know, can we be agile in assessing and responding to those situations in there? You know, can we be innovative? You know, are we collecting the data we need to be innovative or offer new products over time? In terms of external factors, both in external audit, internal audit can give rise to new things that we have to think about. You know, how can we reduce the manual effort to make our getting through audit process simpler? Can we have systems that ease that burden? And I think, you know, through our own experiences, software and tools are certainly heading to aid making that burden easier. Regulatory requirements, things like industry-wide stress tests are things that come up more ad hoc basis. You know, are we in a position? Do we have the capacity, the tools to be able to meet these in an agile basis? Reporting timelines. I think, you know, we're always increasingly under demand to produce information accurately and on a timely basis. We have examples of clients we're sort of, you know, talking to in Asia, working with in Asia. They're looking to have like things like a two-day turnaround to do their year-end close. I'm not sure how they're going to do it, but they're being very aggressive in trying to think about their reporting timelines and getting things done as quickly as possible. IFRS 17, you know, that's going to bring about change, and we're going to be ready to respond to IFRS 17 and be able to produce those numbers as we need on a timely basis, taking into account the new complexities of the CSM and how that will work. Which draws in also then IFRS 17, thinking more about that. It's going to be more than just a straight actuarial system. in terms of our current reporting under MOS, we can do our profit margin largely independently of a lot of other things going on in the business, whereas the CSM roll forward that we'll have, for example, under IFRS 17 is going to have to draw into that process information about surrender benefits I've paid or have not paid, premiums I've received and not received. So it's going to be a lot more integration between the different systems required to complete that year-end valuation reporting under IFRS 17. Shareholder returns. Shareholders always looking to get the most out of their money as well. So that can trigger effectives, triggers for improving cost efficiencies, and particularly when margins are getting squeezed. Can you get more on the cost side to offset margin squeeze? Additional reporting requirements. I think we have a UK example where companies are needing to have recovery and resolution plans, not just companies that are big, deemed too big to fail, but all companies in Europe are having to develop recovery and resolution plans. Mergers and acquisitions. If we're going to make a successful mergers and acquisition, can we do that, respond to that quickly, get the team in place, manage the information that we need to be successful post-acquisition? There can also be, obviously, a cost efficiency element to mergers and acquisitions. We're not showing that here. Certainly some of the mergers Willis Towers Watson have been through over the years has been very focused on bringing two organisations together and reducing the overall cost base for the benefit of shareholders. In there. Finally, just one more, just there on management information, moving towards getting information much more quicker than we have in the past, getting them towards more real-time information so management can respond much quicker to what's happening in the market over time. This is just a sample, and we can start to see why transformation initiatives are becoming more widespread. I think if we look at our agenda for these 2 days here at the Financial Services Forum, there'll be a lot more steps and going into triggers or drivers for transformation in more detail around IFRS 17, future of disability income, pricing and development of risk products. Lots of the topics could fall within drivers of the transformation area. Yeah. Just move on now and talk a little bit about some product transformations. So first I'll have a look at participating products here. So while most portfolios in Australia have been closed or largely closed for quite some time, there's still material portfolios with around 15% of total invested assets of life insurers still within participating portfolios. So while they're not necessarily a big focus, there's still a significant amount of assets tied up in these. I think where transformation has been happening, it's perhaps been happening more in the UK, and we've reflected some of those developments on this slide, but it isn't just the UK there. In a low interest environment, with generally shrinking par liabilities, companies are looking at a number of actions and initiatives in that. One part may be just streamlining the number of sub-funds or product groups, and I've certainly seen companies here in Australia undertaking that, as certain that parts of the business become smaller, combining that with other parts that are still larger, so being able to maintain and manage the business as efficiently as possible over time. Just engaging with customers and making sure they're aware of other options. What's the nature of the product they have? Are there better products out there now that may better suit their ongoing needs on a long-term basis? Divesting portfolios. To some extent, companies in Australia haven't done that, but certainly been an emphasis or practice in the UK where participating portfolios have been divested, merged with other portfolios and managed separately from the initial companies in there. Other aspects, such as outsourcing part of the operation, having part of that operation undertaken by people that are specialising in managing par business, so freeing up your own internal resources. In some more cases, actually converting the product to something different, converting it to a unitised product or a non-participating product, something that's then easier to manage, potentially a more current and relevant product for the policyholders in there. I think in Australian practice, I think a large part of things like the merger of funds has come part through broader merger and acquisition activity. So certainly with AMP taking over the business of NMLA, there were two large part books that have now been pulled together under the one company, been through a Part 9 transformation, all within one organisation, managed under one framework, reduced number of sub-funds sitting within that portfolio. So there's certainly examples within Australia of certain of these practices, but not to the extent yet that we're seeing in other markets, but certainly opportunity for more. Okay. The choice of any particular option will obviously then depend on particular characteristics of the policies, the portfolios. And so, it's not going to be a one-size-all-fits-all situation. But, when it's done properly, it's going to be something that we'll need to look to balance interests of different interests in the participating fund. So the policyholders obviously have their interests, so you need to make sure we're still providing a solution now that will have potentially that greater transparency and flexibility. But making sure they're also still compensated, for the benefits that they currently have in there, so they're not losing that potential upside that they have from the participating framework. From a regulator's perspective, the company may end in a situation with lower risk, they're not having so much downside risk from that participating business, and are offering potentially products more in line with customers' current needs and expectations. And finally, from the insurance perspective, lower complexity, lower costs, lower draw and management time for managing the complexity of the participating business. So if it's done well, it can be a triple win for all those interests of the policyholders, regulators, shareholders. Talk a little now about retirement products, and I think we're going to see a lot of this over coming years in the not-too-distant future. We're starting to see some now, but that's certainly going to accelerate in there. Where currently we have 700 Australians retiring each day. With greater assets, greater longevity than generations have had in the past. So the types of products have been evolving and are subject to a lot of discussion over the recent years. We now have the idea of a comprehensive income product for retirement. Showing some here. Some sort of structures from UK, which we'll talk more about in a minute, but that concept of super still would have different types of structures that can be combined to put together a benefit, a product offering, or offerings to meet a wide range of circumstances. In the past, obviously, there's been barriers to development of retirement income products, but with changes last year, particularly around tax exemption on the earnings in the retirement phase, the scope for more innovative products has opened up. So things like deferred annuities will be much more possible as we move forward in there. So deferred lifetime annuities and also group self-annuitisation products, and we're starting to see examples of those come through. Okay. The UK experienced a significant change similar to this a few years back there with the tax treatment of retirement options. And so they've been able to move away from offering single products, offering a guaranteed income, to offering a range of products with increasing flexibility for the customers. And those are the sorts of things we're sort of illustrating on the slide here. Won't go too much into specific details, but they're giving the customers the ability to choose from different options, different elements or different components with longevity protections, account-based pensions, similar to where I think we'll be heading with SIPPers here in Australia market. Okay. I think what the UK observations do suggest that, you know, retirees with sufficient savings is typically going to have meet their objectives using a combination of products. It's not necessarily going to be a single product will meet the needs of the investors in there. Okay. Okay. As we sort of move forward, I think, you know, there's potentially going to be, you know, new players coming into the market as well that will have an influence. We've seen some variable annuity style offerings over the years haven't necessarily done all that well. That said, you know, that doesn't mean that there's not going to be other innovations that companies are going to look to introduce. For example, it's recently, you know, PIMCO and Allianz have just last week announced they're launching a Australian retirement income business. You know, it's not yet clear or specified, you know, what that business will be. But we certainly wouldn't be surprised if they're going to be looking to, you know, leverage some US-style products, not variable annuities necessarily, but other, you know, leveraging their expertise from other markets here in Australia. Okay. And just to now just a little on protection products before I hand over to Kenny for the next session from there. Okay. I think we're clearly seeing an appetite for products that are simpler products and tailored to specific needs of customers on that. Okay. I think, you know, these products have always been complicated, and that's how, you know, people companies have differentiated between them in the past. You know, different definitions, different bells and whistles that have been added and changed over time to, you know, attract customers that are making them just more difficult to understand and interpret in the hands of customers in there. I think, you know, we heard in the plenary session today the experience about Discovery Life. So, you know, innovation in their sort of innovation in the areas of things like, you know, wearable technologies in life insurance space, encouraging people to change their behaviours and the benefits that has on their experience for their customers and portfolios in there. And yeah, we certainly expect to see more of that. So, for example, yeah, in the drive space, you know, there's certainly examples also where they're looking to change practice, telling people their driving score, how well are they driving, so they compare themselves, challenge themselves a bit against their peers and so forth. Insurers were also going to need to find new ways to target profitable segments of the population. So as an example, Royal London Diabetes Cover is a new product that they've introduced recently, specifically focused and designed to provide cover for diabetics. So designing products for specific segments that might otherwise find it difficult to obtain insurance cover on there. Okay. So with that, pass over to Kenny, who'll look now at practice evolution.
Yeah, thank you, John. So there's often quite a lot that can be learned and gained from sharing with the practices of others, and life in GI is no different. In this slide, we focus on GLMs, and that's GLMs for risk and for demand modelling and their progression into the use for price assessment and price delivery. But of course, GLMs are just one facet of some of the sophisticated analyses that are taking place with GI data. It's really quite rich and sophisticated compared to some of the smaller data sets relatively that life companies hold. But it's an apt example given its long-standing application in the GI space. And we've also seen it roll out to other applications in life, as this diagram will show us in a second. Here we have. It's also kind of an apt example because it was actually two Australians who literally wrote the book on GLM application in insurance data to two academics at Macquarie University. So these dates on this slide are probably more representative of the UK experience, but what I'm trying to show here is the overlap and the lag that we see. I think that can be taken into the Australian case as well. And just from my experience, I'll say that the last three large life UK annuity portfolio M&As I've been involved in have typically involved us deriving a technical value using GLMs. That's a massive data challenge, as much as anything, to be honest. But it's also really contrasting between the experience I've had only a few years before then, where really we were focusing on simple one-way analyses on these type of pieces of work. There's much more higher expectation that we'll go into more sophisticated GLMs. And retention analysis and persistency modelling for life companies is an obvious extension, given there's typically larger quantities of data available there and the dynamics more better fit to a GLM analysis. And we've now worked with life insurers who are interested in exploring the potential that price optimization has in life insurance. They are leveraging their demand models to maximize customer lifetime value, subject to appropriate constraints and fairness. But the simple message here is that GI techniques tend to be a step ahead of those in the life industry. And to get a sense of what would be the next innovation for life actuaries, it can be instructive to follow some of the more advanced methods we're seeing emerge in the GI space. So we've got deep learning, we have AI and machine learning, for example. And my colleagues Paul and James Wu will be discussing this in one of their presentation topics tomorrow, so I encourage you to take a look. So I'm going to turn now to process improvement. And when it comes to processes, the whole industry is on a journey. Insurance companies cannot afford to maintain inefficient processes. They take too long, and the timetable for regulators is closing in. And also, the processes don't usually produce information you really need to make agile decisions either. So we're now going to share with you a number of tips, 9 of them, which are drawn from our experience in the best practice for these projects. The tips in total are structured as top 3 tips we think you should look at the beginning of the project to set up for success. Top 3 tips we think you should do during the course of the project to manage it effectively. And the top 3 tips we think you should do at the end of the project to get it up ready to go for the future. And we'll talk about the importance of people, tools, and processes as we go through them. So we'll start first with what we think you should do at the beginning. Tip 1 is be clear on what you're trying to achieve. And it sounds like a statement of the obvious, but programs tend to fail because they lack clarity of purpose. The primary objective could be to accelerate the current process, or could be to introduce better methodologies, or could be to reduce the cost of ownership, or it could be to improve the quality of MI generated. But don't get these mixed up. If your objective is to accelerate the current process, then don't allow things that change the numbers. As soon as the numbers change, you have all sorts of reconciliation issues to deal with. This is completely unnecessary if you just want the same numbers, but you want them faster. And this is a real issue because speeding up is a common objective, and big transformation projects require big budgets. This also means they're a magnet for small pet projects looking for a budget or wish lists of model improvements that want to go there too. A process transformation project that we are working with fell into this trap. The company invited people from across the organization to feed in on what might be the ideas they'll use to deliver the project, and ended up with 100 initiatives in total. So this company now required 3 to 5 months, to go through and start replanning to resort out and get down to a list of the essentials for the project. So we've also seen a few projects start by mapping out the current process in great detail. And aside from being quite time-consuming and potentially disruptive, this mapping sort of anchors your views too much in this is what we're currently doing. And it means you're only likely to develop solutions that fit with your current process. If your objective is to construct a fundamentally different process that delivers results in 15 days rather than 50, then detailed process maps of the status quo are of limited value. Or worse, you could find yourself 3 or 6 months into the project, down $1 million, and you're not really sure how you're going to deliver what you planned. Then the pressure's really going to be on. Okay. Tip two, is get the right people. We're talking here about successfully delivering multidisciplinary programs, so you need a variety of skill sets. You need creative people who can help to define the vision. You need people who know what systems and technologies are capable of. You need experts in the underlying methodologies and techniques, people who can design and construct efficient workflows, people who can deliver and manage complex projects, and you do, of course, need people who know the existing process. But you also want to benefit. You also want to benefit by leveraging the expertise of people who are not in your organisation and who have done it before. Some of this expertise sits in other organisations. For example, we specialise in the actuarial components and constructing automated processes that ensure the integrity of results and models. But we also recognise that we have to work with other firms who are stronger in the accounting space and how the actuarial and accounting fits together. There's also a point here about the right way to use internal resources. Most internal resources within finance teams operate processes and perform analyses. They're not usually skilled at designing and creating better workflows. Therefore, putting them in project roles that require those skills may not be that useful, especially if they're going to revert to being process operators at the end. So the message from this tip is to think carefully about who you appoint to which roles. We expect these projects to be multi-advisor, which may mean a bit more management overhead, but definitely better for making sure you're exploiting the existing talents. Or looking at another way for reducing the project delivery risk. And tip three, I want to sort of address this point about buy versus build. So has anyone in this room ever found an issue and dived into a solution? Or knocked up a quick fix that did the job, but would have been a challenge for someone else to follow? And in today's world, businesses have reducing tolerance for this type of behaviour. So when it comes to process transformation projects, we need to curb our desire to build it yourself. As good as we think we are at do-it-yourself, these kind of building projects don't usually turn out as well as we would have liked. Instead, it's much more efficient to buy into vendor solutions and focus our efforts on how to implement those within the business. So the vendor community offers quite a wide range of solutions these days. And for us, because it's a core part of our business, we invest substantially and we take this out to our clients so we know how they're doing and we can spread that cost across hundreds of clients around the world. So I'm talking about technology solutions to make the point, but this tip is wider than that. For example, when you're developing new models using your chosen modelling tool, or when you're working out how to optimise some other component within the overall process, buy into the people who know best how to make that tool do what you want it to do. So I have another example to highlight this tip. So a medium-sized company we worked with has a very manual process that started to creak. They wanted to establish an automatic way of controlling the models to do their runs. And the person who led the modelling team was quite technically minded and stood up to this challenge. But he began writing his own scripts for the purpose, and his focus was on automation and working largely alone. He wasn't building controls, and he was focusing solely on the actuarial tools rather than the end-to-end solution. So when he was finished, he created something that is a fraction of the functionality that a workflow automation tool has out of the box, and he's also made himself a huge key person risk for the organisation. Now, tip four is about firing up the technology. Whenever we onboard an outsourcing client's actuarial process, we undertake a transformation project ourselves, and we have the goal of improving operational efficiency. We want to make it very quick, very steady, delivering the right management information, and in a tightly controlled environment. And there are two phases of this onboarding. There's acceleration and improvement. For acceleration, our approach is to employ a combination of power. So first, we minimise runtime using vGrid, so that's a scalable cloud computing. And automation, we install Unify, which is a workflow management tool, to perform a controlled and steady process. This allows us to preserve the current reporting process and encase it in an environment where it runs super quick at the press of a button. And so this captures massive time saving and reduced manual dependency risk quite substantially without changing any of the components or any of the numbers. And it frees resources after acceleration, and this is a very strategic point because this allows us to use those resources to build into other outsourcing solutions. So we get benefits there. So tip five is on taking people on the journey. And whether it is in achieving the change itself or as part of the business as usual process, in the end, people are the key resource within the organization. And because they are the key resources, I'd like to touch on two key aspects that are commonly overlooked. The first is management and business information, and the second is transitioning to the new order. So with MI and BI, continuing with obsolete and overproduced information is just foolish. It's critical to understand the information needs are, what do people need, and what's missing. It's the must-haves versus the nice-to-haves versus the unnecessary. There might not be the appropriate amount of objectivity to assess what is the optimal trimmed-down version of necessary information. External support can be critical in this area, then, in designing the right information pack to support the understanding of this new information. And the new order will include robotic process automation. RPA is increasingly replacing human intervention, however, it is not replacing people. New skill sets are evolving. And most of you are acquainted with RPA, I think, such as a polling mechanism that triggers a run once only certain data has entered certain folders, data cleaning techniques to complete or missing fields or perform data transformation, workflow engines that trigger actuarial model runs. Although these tools can deliver an operationally efficient process, it is the people that add value through results analysis and interpretation. And because the company will be operating in a fundamentally different environment, it is critical to handle the challenges of their transitions. People are generally resistant to change. They view this as a threat to their comfort zone, their daily lives, or even as a threat to being rendered obsolete. There's a cultural change needs to take place then. And tip 6 is on managing interaction with other initiatives. Of course, your project is the utmost importance. However, you're not alone. There are two types of other styles of projects that are running, usually. There are competing projects running in parallel. However, they have knock-on consequences on one another. And there's multidiscipline, cross-functional projects that have the same goals. Now, if we couple these project modes, if you like, with BAU, depending on the approach taken to roll out, BAU can be hit intermittently or all in one go. Therefore, it's key in the planning to bring the BAU responsible individuals into the planning process. And one such cross-function multidiscipline project is looming, and that's the IFRS 17 standard. And this will require an interactive approach. There'll be conflict in priorities within sub-projects, and the always-present, if we change one thing, we'll have knock-on effects on something else. So an agile approach amongst the various work streams with periodical sponsor interaction will go a long way to reduce the risk of the impacts of all these separate problem-solving exercises. And tip 7 is on ensuring you realise the benefits. And there's two key aspects of this. The first relates to how you introduce new parts of the new process. So it's something that happens at the end of the work stream within a project rather than at the end of the entire project. If you change a component of your process that used to require 3 FTEs and now requires 2.5, guess what? You still need 3 FTEs, except one of them is now half utilised. The way to avoid this is to manage the introduction of new things so you can take whole people out. And this is what we do with transformation underlying our actuarial outsourcing activities. We make lots of changes, and then we store them up and release them into the live environment in chunks. This way, every chunk is of sufficient scale to drive down the requirement in people. It also means each chunk is of sufficient impact that it reinforces the people involved that you're introducing something new and transformative. The second aspect is about defining the point at which you deem the project to have completed. It is natural to think of a project completion as when you've finished creating the new thing you're building. Our messages don't do that. Instead, you should treat project completion as a point at which you switch off and decommission the old stuff that you used to do. This happens later in time, but we say this for good reason. It ensures you absolutely kill off everything that used to happen and you don't want to happen anymore. That means no more pet spreadsheets and workarounds that people used to use to overcome limitations. If these things are allowed to cling on, then there's a risk that they'll gradually creep back into the existing core process, and your wonderful vision has been compromised. What's more, if you don't kill off the old stuff before the project is wound up, you're going to find it much harder to kill it off when it's into BAU. Also, the retention of anything legacy is an excuse for people to resist moving with the times. Ultimately, what I'm saying here is your program doesn't finish until you've stopped using old tools that are no longer required. You've terminated software licenses and saved on fees you don't need to pay anymore. And you've eliminated all the inefficient processes and ad hoc stuff that used to depend on expensive humans. And tip 8 is on preserving the investment. This is our second tip for ending the program well. So you've just spent a lot of money on creating this wonderful new reporting process. So the last thing you want is for it to deteriorate over time. So this tip is a checklist of things to work through to focus on how you operate going forward before you sign off the project. Starting first with the people and process aspects, the checklist items are: one, if you're disbanding a project team and handing over responsibility to BAU, then you need to make sure the new people are trained up in the methodology and ways of working, and also how to maintain the new process going forward. And two is to make sure you end up with the right team size, skills mix, organizational structure, and reward environment to operate efficiently. You may have reduced some of the people cost, but of course you want to make sure that your people footprint is still appropriate. This could include people moving to pay-as-you-go sort of basis, making sure that you're not staffing up to the peaks and having spare capacity in between. And three is to impose a control cycle attitude to how you maintain the new process. For example, carry out regular health checks and maintain periodic dialogue with your vendors. This will help you keep pace of the ideas and developments in the industry and establish a continuous improvement culture. Then from a technology perspective, and recognizing you have to keep pace with ongoing developments, there are a couple of things you can do to help avoid spikes in development costs. Firstly, if you aren't already, consider adopting cloud computing so that your cost model for compute power is pay-as-you-go. This avoids fixed costs of maintaining and then refreshing a grid, which would be underutilized in between peak periods. And secondly, consider software as a service or infrastructure as a service. Excuse me. This will transfer responsibility for keeping pace with technology and executing periodic upgrades to your service provider. And thirdly, keep an eye on what is happening with robotics. Without doubt, new ways of artificial intelligence will emerge, and all of us need to embrace that development and deploy it for future reporting activities. All of the above represent your go-forward operating model. Each item on your checklist has the potential to significantly change how you operate and how successful you are at managing the quality of the new process you've just created. The last tip is tip 9, and that's just to celebrate success properly. If you finished all these tips and you finished your process improvement, I'm sure it's been a long slog, and then it's important that you celebrate that appropriately. Well done, you. And so if this wine isn't your way of celebrating, then I include other options. I don't know if that fits anyone here. Yeah. And there's my one. Okay. And that brings us to the end. Thank you.